Thank you. If it pleases the court, the name is Rufus Holderson, registration 14361. I'm here today representing the defendant appellant in this matter, Mary Brown. If it pleases the court and subject to questions you might ask, I would like to focus on some principal factors that I think make this case unique and bring us here today. The first of that is the fact that the covenants, the controlling documents in this case, were amended during the middle of a construction project. And as I will discuss, those changes spawn several consequences that are important to this case, and that I believe the trial court either ignored or simply got wrong. The second of those factors is that the covenants have a clear condition precedent prior to going to court. And in this case, the plaintiff, Moonridge, simply failed to abide by that condition precedent. And the third is the trial court's dealing with the covenant's adoption of the Uniform Building Code and the application of that. With respect to the first of those factors, one of the interesting things in this case, I find at least, is that squarely in the middle of this project, the covenants were amended. We have covenants in 1996 when the subdivision is first formed. We have this project beginning in 2005. In the middle of the project, in 2007, January of 2007, those covenants are amended. And I think it's...
And the structure is constructed, meets the second set of covenants?
No, the structure is completed after the second set of covenants is enacted. The covenants are enacted in January.
My question is, does the structure comply with the amended covenants?
I don't know, because the amended covenants were never suitable. That was never an issue before the trial court. Frankly, I've never gone through those amended covenants to take a close look at them and say, okay, what happens under these particular covenants, because they were never sued upon. Moonridge chose to bring an action only under the original covenants. So that's a clear question. I would say if we just focused on the one provision that defines square footage, yes, probably it does. But again, that's not what the case is about, because Moonridge only sued under the original covenants, if that answers your question. Under the plain language of these documents, it's very clear that the old covenants applied until January 1 of 2007. The new covenants apply thereafter. Here are the legal consequences that come from that. First, and the easiest one to discuss on appeal, and I think dispositive of this appeal, is the fact that, plainly stated, the court has no jurisdiction to specifically enforce covenants that are no longer in effect. Covenants are, or the purpose of an injunction is not to punish, it's to avoid future harm. And for that reason, the injunctive relief has to be coextensive and consistent with the document that's being specifically enforced. Quite clearly, the old covenants are not enforced. They're gone. So in that regard, the trial court erred, exceeded its jurisdiction by permanently enforcing covenants that are already gone. In the same token, the trial court also erred because it added provisions to those covenants and specifically enforced the provisions that it added. For instance, the trial court required that the Browns allow Moonridge to come in and view their property. That's not in the covenants. It prohibited them from heating certain portions of the house. That's not in the covenants. It required them to lower the basement ceiling to 60 inches. There's no standard in the covenants that speak to that. The trial court.
Well, those were all just means of enforcing the 5,000-foot limit, though. What you're saying is that the court can't order a party to do something to require enforcement of the covenant. As a practical matter, it can't order them to do anything unless that practical thing is mentioned in the covenants.
I think that's partially correct.
Why couldn't the court have simply ordered demolition of the house?
If the court had ordered that, the subject on appeal was whether it abused its discretion because of the waste necessary. And there is some significant case law that we cited, at least in the written closing arguments, that suggest, no, if you wait, plaintiff, until the project is completed, those issues are now moot. You can't wait until the end of the day and then have the structure entirely removed. But I would submit that would perhaps have been and appropriate, or at least it would have been a way for the court to approach it and not have to rewrite the covenants. In this particular instance, it adds provisions and say, now you have to comply with these covenants.
So in some circumstances, it could order destruction of the residence, but it couldn't order a remedy to comply with the same covenant short of destruction, because it's not specifically mentioned in the covenants.
I think the same reasoning that applies to destruction now applies to adding provisions, and that is as follows. Because Moon Ridge waited until everything was completed before they stepped up to say, listen, this is too large, and oh, by the way, these other things offend us, it's too late to do it.
You're ignoring a lot of history, aren't you? I mean, she submitted plans that were complied and were approved and built on different plans. She submitted plans that were refused, all because of the 5,000 square foot limit. She knew clearly that the residents had to have couldn't exceed 5,000 square feet.
The thing that was unclear, Your Honor, is whether a basement counted toward the 5,000 feet limit. That's what was unclear under the covenants. That was what the back and forth was between Ms. Brown and the association. Yes, she submitted plans in 2004, and the association essentially said, no, those do not comply, because it would have grossly exceeded 5,000 square feet. It was a walkout basement, very traditional. They said, no, that's not acceptable. She goes back to the drawing board and comes up with something entirely different.
A 9-foot crawl space.
Yes, and if we listen to the testimony of the builder as to why that happens, it's because this house is dug into the side of a hill. And certainly if it's, you have to go a little bit deeper to make it work out level-wise. That's why it's a 9-foot crawl space. It could have been stepped up the hill. He admits that. But it was that the choice was made at the time to simply, as his term, to hog it out so that the thing is built, it's easier to build and easier to deal with. And
it could have required her to fill the basement.
A court could perhaps have required that. But again, there's no standard in the covenants that say a basement is X feet and a crawl space is Y feet. There's no particular standard. It's undefined.
What ended up happening here? I mean, wasn't it finished out essentially as a basement?
No. What happens is there's a wooden floor on the basement to walk around on.
Okay.
And if you look at the pictures, we see insulation hanging, we see open pipes. It's not finished out. It's not finished space. It's not livable space in any regard.
My basement in my house isn't finished either, but it's habitable space. I mean, are you saying that it has to be finished? And if so, where do you get that from? Is that in the covenants? Is that in the building code? Is that somewhere else?
I was asking you a question that it's not finished space. Yeah. I don't see that the covenants or the building code that applies talk about finished space in any particular relevance to this transaction. It just doesn't matter. It defines an area as the area within some perimeter walls. That's it. There's no further discussion to say that if it exceeds 5 feet, then it's habitable and therefore counts toward the square footage, or that it doesn't. It simply doesn't apply there. The confusion in this case is because the plans, the preliminary plans, simply called it a crawl space. Now, if we look at the profile of those plans, it says it's 10 feet, but it calls it a crawl space. And that was the source of the confusion. Nothing to do with how tall they particularly were. Did that answer your question, sir? Kind of?
I think under the uniform build. I don't think there's any maximum. More than that, I suppose. Requires a 4 to 5.
There is a minimum requirement. My recollection is it's 3 foot. I don't know for sure. There is no maximum. I think somewhere in the record, it appears that subsequent to this litigation being filed, Gunnison County adopted a standard that says anything in excess of 5 feet is going to be considered a basement and not a crawl space. That was to address the issue of people building in hilly terrain, digging large basements and calling it a crawl space and not paying the county tax for it. And that's what the trial court glommed onto to require this 5 foot spacing. But that doesn't apply here. That's something that is enacted after the fact. It has nothing to do with this transaction, it has nothing to do with these particular covenants. Going back, if we take a look at these amended covenants, the consequences, in addition to the trial court impermissibly enforcing them, there being general nullity at this point, Also, we have the issue of proof. We have actions taken under the old covenants, actions taken under the new covenants. And I think it was incumbent upon Moon Ridge to say, okay, these are the actions that you took, Ms. Brown, under the old covenants, and this is how they violated the old covenants. These are the actions taken under the new covenants, and these are how they violated the new covenants. They didn't do that. They lumped it into one thing. The problem with it is, and if the trial court at Moon Ridge are correct that these covenants are not violated and that the statute of limitations doesn't run until there's a certificate of occupancy, is that the old covenants were never violated until they had long since been superseded and replaced. The next issue is simply novation. We quite squarely meet the four elements.
Make the argument in the trial court that it complied with the new covenants?
No. No. We made the argument in the trial court that it was incumbent upon Moon Ridge to sue under the new covenants and to press its claim under those new covenants. That's the argument we made.
How are you prejudiced by either one?
Because, again, if there are actions taken under the old covenants that violated them, two things will result. One is the statute of limitations has necessarily run on them. Because they were terminated as of January of 07, this case was not brought until October of 08, clearly beyond the one-year statute. That's consequence number one. Those actions that occurred after January of 07, had they been prosecuted under the new covenants, and had they been found to be violated, then perhaps no statute of limitations issue. But that's not what happened here. They were all lumped into one set of covenants. And I don't know, by the way, if they would win under the new covenants. Here's why. They have claimed that under that the house exceeds 5,000 square feet. Well, perhaps it did under the old covenants, and perhaps it does under the new. But having not pressed the second one, and because there's a novation here, how could this not be a novation? The old covenants are superseded, or the new ones are superseded and replaced. That's the term. How can there not be a novation? And there is. So that claim is gone. They didn't build something, a different structure beyond 5,000 to violate the second covenants, did they? No. It's an old violation, and it can't be governed by the second set of covenants. So those need to be factored in. Now, some of the things they complained about, Goodrich complained about, did occur after the second set of covenants were enacted. And those should have been parsed out and looked at to say, okay, fine, these actions were taken without board approval, And we should have looked at that at the time, but that's not what happened. The trial court simply said, we're going to enforce the old covenants, irrespective of the fact that they're superseded and replaced. And in doing so, I think the trial court erred, and certainly erred, in trying to impose injunctive relief on that basis. And with that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Please the court.
Whenever you're ready.
I'm Jacqueline Casey with Roth Gerber Johnson & Lyons, registration number 36768. With me at council table and on the briefs is Mike Plocky of the Roth Gerber firm as well. Your Honors, this is not a case, as Mrs. Brown would have you believe, of the big bad HOA sitting on its rights for years and then selectively enforcing some unconscionable covenant provision against an unsuspecting homeowner. It's not this case. In this case, as Judge Roy noted, Mrs. Brown knew she was subject to these covenants, knew that the covenants imposed a 5,000 square foot limitation on the size of home she could build, that included basements, and knew that she had to have her plans approved by the Moon Ridge subdivision.
Talk about this basement.
Sure.
Or crawl space, or whatever it is. The plans that were approved show a 9 to 10 foot high space. It's designated as a crawl space. Okay, now those plans were approved, so the board knew that this was going to be a full height space when it approved those plans. What changed about the construction that led the board to believe, oh, this isn't a crawl space, it's a basement?
Well, in fact, the testimony, the evidence at trial, Your Honor, reflected dispute over whether or not the board understood that the lower level would be a solid 10-foot open space. The plans do reflect, and on one, I think, cross-section reflect one of the basement walls being 10-foot high. But given the fact that it was denominated an unfinished crawl space, the board was under the assumption the entire time that it would indeed be a crawl space, which industry standard says is something you have to crawl around inside, rather than a 10-foot high space with a plywood subfloor and framing one step away from being a finished space. All you have to do is throw up some drywall. So until the home was constructed and complete, the board had no idea that the entire basement would be a finished floor 10-foot high space. That was not what was represented on the approved plans.
What about this novation issue? The new covenants say that they are intended to supersede and replace the original covenants. That seemed to be about as clear a novation language as I can imagine.
Well, there's a fourth element to novation. The four elements are valid obligation existing, an agreement to abide by a new contract, and a valid new contract. The fourth element is what's missing here, which is extinguishment of the old obligation by substitution of a new. Here, despite
why doesn't the word supersede take care of that?
The word supersede in no way relieves Mrs. Brown of her existing obligation to comply with the covenants that were in place before.
It says supersede and replace. To me, common sense tells me the old covenants are gone.
Well, the industry in the standard, and that was testified to by Mrs. Brown's own expert, Mr. Helland, her architect, was that the code and the building restrictions that are in effect at the time that the building permit is pulled on the home is what applies. Taking that into consideration, the covenants that were in place when Mrs. Brown pulled her building permit and commenced construction on her home had to be the ones that applied. Any representation by Mrs. Brown to say that had the covenants changed the day before to suddenly limit the square footage to 1,000 square feet that she would have complied, that laid into construction, that's simply false. As Judge Roy pointed out earlier today, it doesn't matter which one of the covenants applies in this case. She violated them both. And in fact, at trial, there was evidence of the original covenants and the amended covenants. The restrictions with respect to plan approval and the square footage limitation size are very similar. In fact, if anything, the amended covenants are more specific with respect to those issues. So if the amended covenants applied, Mrs. Brown's house still would have violated. It would have been a non-issue. Now, Mrs. Brown makes point to say that Moon Ridge does not or did not assert a claim based on the amended covenants. Paragraph 4 of the complaint, and that's at page 4 of the record, expressly identifies the covenants and their subsequent amendments, and then goes on to assert claims against Mrs. Brown. Yes, the focus of Moon Ridge's claims had always been on the original covenants, given the industry standard that those covenant restrictions should apply given the timing of the building permit. That was the focus of the case. But the amended covenants were introduced into evidence by Mrs. Brown at trial, and the result is either set of covenants Mrs. Brown's house violates the covenants.
It's hypothetical then, since we're fond of those on the court.
Sure.
Let's say that a homeowner starts to build a house under one set of covenants and it does not violate those covenants. Okay, midway through construction, the board changes the covenants such that this house now violates the amended covenants. I take it the board wouldn't say, you've got to change your house, would it?
No, that's absolutely right, it wouldn't. And that's because the industry standard says when you pull your building permit, those are the standards that govern. It's called grandfathering.
You're going back to the building code. Okay, we know that that was what the experts testified to about the building code. They said that the building code then in effect is what governs. And you're trying to kind of extend that to covenants, it sounds to me.
Well, I believe that the testimony at trial was in fact the building requirements or standards applicable at the time the building permit is pulled are what apply. The experts did not specifically testify to the UBC. I think one of the experts specifically testified to that point, but the other one said it's the standards that apply at the time the building permit is pulled that govern the construction of the home.
Right,
and
so
that doesn't matter whether it's the building code or the covenants. They're all restrictions and construction requirements.
Let me flip around the hypothetical. Let's say that the home does not comply with the original covenants that are in effect when construction begins, but amended covenants are enacted and the home would comply. I mean, are you saying that even under those circumstances, the board would be within its rights to insist that the home be altered to comply with the original covenants, even though if construction started today, there'd be no problem?
Presumably that would be the case, but I would also expect that the homeowner would then apply to the board for a variance and say, can I amend my construction now to meet the new covenants and expand the size limitation or whatever the covenant restriction was that was previously violated and is no longer. But that's not the case here. Both sets of covenants required 5,000 square feet or less, including basements, and that's the covenant that was violated under either set.
And you get the including basements from what?
Well, the definition of floor area, as a matter of fact, and that's what's incorporated into the covenants via the UBC, is the usable area under the horizontal projection of the roof. So while it doesn't specifically say basements, that surely includes basements when it's one of the floors of the home. And so the fact that the covenants incorporate the UBC and the UBC definition of floor area specifically into the covenant provision with respect to maximum density, which is the covenant that was violated in this case. So that definition was incorporated into the covenants. That's what was relied upon by Moon Ridge's experts in calculating the square footage and determining that Mrs. Brown's home exceeded 7,500 square feet. It was a house and a half at that point.
Casey, let me change gears a little bit and ask you about the provision in the trial court's injunction that says that the homeowners association has ongoing, which I view as perpetual, right to inspect the home here. First thing I want to know is, under what standard of review do we test that particular provision? For example, is it an abuse of discretion? And how in the world can that not be an abuse of discretion here, when the whole purpose of this was to make sure that she made the alterations, the specific alterations that the court required in the other part of its injunction? I mean, isn't that going a bit far to say we've got the right to come in, inspect your house anytime we want, as long as we give you 10 days notice? It seems something pretty broad about that to me.
Well, you're correct that the right standard of review for imposition of any injunction is abuse of discretion. So that's the appropriate standard to review this by. With respect to the right to enter and inspect, it's simply an enforcement mechanism. The evidence in the case reflected that Mrs. Brown didn't always comply when she said that she would. In fact, after multiple hearings and notices that her home was going to exceed 5,000 square feet, she couldn't build plans that the HOA had not approved.
Well, I understand that. So why not give her a certain amount of time to make these alterations and give the Homeowners Association a certain amount of time to make the inspection, but perpetual, forever? I mean, what's the purpose of that?
Well, in fact, the court's remedy imposed here was, I believe that the court was attempting to balance the equities here. As Judge Jones pointed out, the court very well could have ordered Mrs. Brown to tear down her entire home. It didn't comply. But what the court was trying to do here was reach a compromise. She had expended a substantial amount of money to build this home. There was a midpoint, I guess, between tearing down the home and leaving her with her home that violates the covenants, and that was to install a 2x4 grid across the basement. Now, we all know that it's not that hard to put up and take down 2x4 grids. So the sort of ongoing inspection, right, was so that the HOA could have some comfort that Mrs. Brown was in fact complying with the injunction.
I understand that, but forever? I mean, what if they go in and they inspect it and she's complied? Under the injunction, they've still got the right to go in and inspect her home anytime they want.
Well, I think that was the court's way of reaching some sort of compromise here to allow the HOA some comfort that the home would not continue to violate the covenant, but to allow Mrs. Brown, well, to permit Mrs. Brown to keep her house up, quite frankly.
And if she sells the house, does the Homeowners Association have the right to go inspect it when there's a new homeowner in there?
Well, the injunction issued against Mrs. Brown, yes, there was a document recorded in the property records that put prospective purchasers on notice that this house was subject to the covenants and subject to this rule, but the injunction only enters against Mrs. Brown. So I would suspect that, and I haven't thought this out hypothetically speaking, if a new homeowner was to purchase the home, that this injunction itself has no bearing against that homeowner. Now, that doesn't mean that the new homeowner doesn't have the obligation to comply with the covenants, which in this case, compliance with the covenants would be keeping up that 2x4 grid, but ultimately that inspection right has only entered against Mrs. Brown. I'd like to go back and address one of the issues that I believe has been muddied a little bit on the record, and that is with respect to preservation of the statute of limitations argument here. In this case, Mrs. Brown moved for summary judgment on the breach of contract claim, arguing that the statute of limitations barred the claim. Moon Ridge cross-moved for summary judgment, arguing that the court should enter judgment on that breach of contract claim. The result of that order on cross motions for summary judgment was that both of those motions were denied. No judgment entered in favor of any party. The summary judgment order didn't end the litigation. It only went on to say that the case should go to trial. And in fact, after that summary judgment order, the court in this case made that intent very clear with two subsequent orders issued after the summary judgment, but before trial. You can find those orders at pages 2082 and 2094 of the record. Now, the first order clarifying summary judgment specifically states that order, referring to the summary judgment order, denied defendant's motion for summary judgment related to the statute of limitations, held that the 1994 UBC applied, dismissed the nuisance claim, and limited plaintiff's damages to a nominal damages claim. Now, the day after that order was entered, the parties had a status conference. Moon Ridge showed up thinking it had won a whole lot on summary judgment, thinking that the only thing that was left was to determine the scope of the injunction. And after that status conference, Moon Ridge found out it was wrong, and the court entered another order that same day that stated, the court clarified its intention with respect to the ruling on certain matters. More particularly, that the intention was a more narrow ruling, specifically that the original covenants applied, that the original covenants contemplated a maximum of 5,000 square feet, that it included all floors, but not the plaintiff had prevailed on its claim, and particularly as noted in the order, estoppel remained, and further, that the other applicable affirmative defenses remained as well. Appellate courts do not review orders denying summary judgment because they are not determinations on the merit. Once trial begins, those motions for summary judgment become moot. And under the Colorado Supreme Court's precedent in the Jones case, Mrs. Brown was required to move for directed verdict or make a motion JNOV in order to preserve those issues.
Well, as I understand the summary judgment order, though, the court ruled as a matter of law that summary judgment did not bar the claim. Now, it's true that the court didn't go farther and say that Moon Ridge was entitled to judgment on its claim, but it seems to me the court ruled definitively that the statute of limitations defense was out.
The court explained its rationale for denying Mrs. Brown's summary judgment motion. Moon Ridge didn't somehow cross move for a declaratory judgment that the statute of limitations didn't bar the claim. The only thing that happened as a result of that order was a denial of the summary judgment order.
But it denied it. You're missing the point. It denied the motion because it held as a matter of law the statute of limitations defense failed, not because there were remain genuine issues of material fact. That would be a big difference.
The Jones case actually stands for the proposition that there is no difference between those things, Your Honor. In fact, in Jones, the court said that a denial of summary judgment, whether based on an issue of disputed fact or based on an issue of law, must be reasserted at trial in a motion for directed verdict or a JNOV, or it is not preserved.
I don't think that's what Jones says. That would be pointless. I mean, that would be a complete waste of time. Once the court's definitive ruled as a matter of law that a defense doesn't apply, I don't think Jones requires that party to then present evidence of that defense and then a pro forma denial of it again at trial. That's pointless.
Well, the Jones court, I see that my time is up. If you let me finish the question, the Jones court in fact dealt with a similar issue where there was a resolution on summary judgment, that resolution with respect to an issue of law. Now, the litigant in that case, Jones, said, I thought that that meant that I couldn't present any evidence at trial. And the Jones court specifically rejected that, saying, no, in fact, you should have moved for directed verdict or made a motion JNOV in order to preserve that issue. The fact that you may have been confused about whether or not you were entitled to present further evidence on that issue based on a summary judgment denial is irrelevant. And I see that my time is up. I appreciate it. Moon Ridge respectfully requests that the court affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you,
counsel. You have a little under 2 minutes, sir.
I shall speak quickly. The injunction in this case, following up on Judge Loeb's question, it clearly applies to successors and assigns. That's what the court stated. That's what's recorded. That's impermissible under Rule 65. The enforcement in this instance sure Moon Ridge has a need to enforce every subdivision covenant, every subdivision association does, but guess what? If a criminal defendant came to this court and said, you know, I was convicted previously of possessing cocaine, and now this judge has entered a permanent injunction allowing the police to search my house, this court would have no trouble striking that particular provision.
This isn't an issue of constitutional law. It's a question, isn't it, of abuse of discretion, and that's what I was trying to get my hands under. Is this abuse of discretion given the facts that came out of trial?
I think it's an abuse of discretion because it adds provisions that do not apply to the covenants and requires that Ms. Brown comply with them. Yes, it's an abuse. It's also a constitutional issue because the state court is an actor, a state actor, and this is an unreasonable search and seizure. There are no standards. All Moon Ridge has to say is, we want to come in and look at your house. The fact is, it is true that the preliminary plans quite clearly show four corners of the house, of the basement area. They're all 10 foot. Yes, there was confusion about the use of the term unfinished crawl space, but it's clearly depicted. The plywood floor makes no difference on how you calculate square footage. It is counted irrespective of whether it's dirt or plywood or polished marble, frankly. It counts as square footage if it counts at all. The industry standard is harped on at great length by Moon Ridge. Really, the only discussion came in deposition testimony by an architect who said, I think the code, which by the way changed also during the period of time this construction was going, the Uniform Building Code went from 1994 to 2003 code, that changed. Frankly, under the 2003 code, basements didn't count quite specifically. They don't count whatsoever. They did in the 1994 code. That was the purpose of that particular testimony by the architect. It has nothing to do with construing these covenants. I noticed my time is out.
Thank you, counsel.
You bet.
We thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.